Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to George Eaton about Ed Balls and the economy, Raphael Bear will be interviewing Ryan Shorthouse of Bright Blue about Tory modernisation, and I talked to Laurie Penny and Ian Steadman about online abuse. By George Eaton, the editor of The Staggers, to talk about, let's talk about Ed Balls. You interviewed the Shadow Chancellor this week. He offered you a mince pie. He seemed in good spirits. What else did you find when you talked to him?
Yes, as you say, he was in good spirits, and I thought I might find a rather tetchy figure. I mean, Balls had quite a difficult end to his year with a
he
lot
had
of criticism.
A terrible response to the autumn statement.
Yeah.
It was universally panned, I think, as movie critics put it.
Yes, and that started off a new wave of speculation over his position. But he seems genuinely relaxed, and I think fairly confident that his reputation can recover from the battering it's had recently.
And George Osborne made a big play on Monday about austerity, about looking beyond the next election, about more cuts, essentially. Particularly, we've been talking all week about the problem of the fact that the welfare bill is half pensions and there's not a lot of, excess fat, if there ever was, left in it. Where are Labour on those kind of issues?
So Ed Balls has said that he'd take the winter fuel payments from the wealthiest 5% of pensioners. But that's really a symbolic move. It saves 100 million, which isn't nothing. And actually, I think a point worth noting this week is that when the Conservatives dismiss means testing pensioner benefits on the grounds they don't raise much money, that doesn't take account of the fact that things like the benefit cap and the bedroom tax also don't raise much money. They are
so
really for...
bedroom tax was only a couple of hundred million, wasn't
yes.
it? So it's about what messages you want to send out.
So where are Labour on this? I mean, on cuts, I sort of tried to pin Balls down several times. His view seems to be that a Labour government could do more to improve the underlying growth of the economy and its and levels of productivity, and actually lessen the need for cuts, which some economists would agree with. And politically, it is difficult for them because Osborne has managed to frame this debate so successfully. But I think Miliband is confident that 2015 really will be the living standards election. And one of the interesting things that came out from the recent Ashcroft poll on Tory-leaning voters is that very few of them are actually interested in the deficit now. He said that they saw the economy solely through the prism, or largely through the prism, of cost of living.
So, I mean, obviously the Conservatives have tried to get them things like the freeze and fuel duty. They've also laid a trap, haven't they, with the capping bills that are coming through in the summer. Could you explain to me again what those are?
So Osborne has said he's going to cap total welfare spending for the first time. So he's already introduced a cap on household benefits. This will be on the total welfare budget. And he's also said he's going to introduce a charter for budget responsibility, which commits the next government to running a surplus at some time in the next parliament and using any spare money to pay down debt rather than spending more on public services.
That's a classic Osborne trap in a sense, isn't it? Because even if the Conservatives were elected with in a coalition or majority, they could probably find some way of weaseling it out, in the same way that a lot of the discussions about the EU referendum have been about setting a trap for Labour.
Yes, and Labour's response, so one of their responses is to say, well, Osborne hasn't stuck to his own fiscal rules in this parliament. Why should we expect him to do any different in the next? My guess is that Labour will probably table amendments to these and say, well, we are also committed to fiscal responsibility and controlling welfare spending, but we'll do it in a different way.
Yeah. And finally, you mentioned in your interview with Ed Balls, he was notably quite nice about Nick Clegg, which marks a pretty big shift in tone from the way that he used to talk about him, and even from the slightly more cool kind of it's not about people, it doesn't matter, you know, we'd all get on with the job in hand kind of rhetoric that we've had. Is that a play to try and kind of worry Nick Clegg, or do you think that's a genuine overture of friendship?
I think it's a genuine overture, and I think it's in part because there has been a softening of the Lib Dem position as well. So often after 2010, they said, well, maybe we could work with Miliband, but we really couldn't work with Bulls, who, you know, perhaps unfairly is seen as an incredibly tribal figure, and as someone who played a part in ensuring that the negotiations failed last time. But I think there are a few big things going on that have sort of sparked this shift among Labour figures, of whom Bulls is obviously a significant one. I mean, Labour's poll lead is now about half as large as it was at the end of last year. Clegg's position as leader is secure. I mean, after Eastleigh, after sort of the humbling of Vince Cable at the most recent Lib Dem conference, I think it's safe to assume he is going to be there in May 2015. For a period, Labour's default assumption was that Clegg would be gone by then, and they'd be dealing with Vince Cable or Tim Farron. And I also think that singling Clegg out and saying, well, he has to go as a condition of a Labour-Lib Dem coalition doesn't seem very Milibandite. So his politics is all about sort of principles and ideas, and sort of framing that debate around personalities.
We don't like
something...
Nick Clegg, he's a collaborator.
Yeah.
He's not very Milibandite. No, I know, I see what you mean about that. So, and actually the way that the polls are looking at the moment, a Lib Lab coalition is one of the higher likelihoods, right?
Yes. I still think, you know, Labour have a chance of a small majority simply because of the good fortune of a coalition and a right-wing party that's taking votes from the Tories. But certainly, you know, a poll lead of six points, sort of 16 months away from the election, is not large enough for them to be confident of a majority. And could Labour do a deal with the Lib Dems if they're the single largest party? I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, people forget, you know, David Cameron dismissed Clegg as his
favourite joke.
I mean,
yeah.
Before 2010. I mean, one of the rules of politics is that you will always do what is necessary to keep power or to retain it.
I think that's probably a very good note to end on. Thank you very much, George.
Podcast on the road, on location in Westminster. I'm joined now by Ryan Shorthouse, who is the director of Bright Blue, often described as the modernizing think tank for the Conservative Party, the progressive wing of the Conservative Party. Maybe Ryan, you know, you intervened over Christmas in the debate about what should happen to the Conservative Party, where its future lies, and that provoked some discussion about what is left of the modernising or compassionate or progressive wing of the Conservative Party. Maybe you could start by explaining what Bright Blue actually is and what it aims to do.
Okay, so Bright Blue is a pressure group and think tank for liberal conservatives, and we're very supportive of Cameron's drive and people around Cameron to modernise the Conservative Party. And of course, there is a criticism of modernisers that it's a small clique of people right at the top of the party. We want to say, no, actually, this has a lot of grassroots support amongst activists, councillors and MPs who are supportive of the modernising direction. And for us, liberal conservatism draws on the best of our conservative roots. So first is this idea of optimism about individuals' potential, but also the direction of society. Secondly, sort of drawing on our Burkean roots, it's a sort of scepticism of ideology And a belief in evidence and working out policy and politics in a practical manner. And thirdly, a belief in markets, both in public services and consumer markets, but using government where inequities and inefficiencies arise. So we have a clear set of principles that draw on the best of different conservative traditions. And we want to show that there's a lot of groundswell support for this liberal consensus.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I think a lot of people, and probably a lot of people listening to this podcast, will think, no, there isn't. The Conservative Party is doing everything it can to try and look a bit more like UKIP in desperate fear of losing the next election because of angry reactionary voters going off in that direction. And that was very much seemed to be the subtext or even the foretext of what you wrote. I think it was in The Independent over Christmas. So do you feel the need that your side of the party has to speak louder or sort of express it, these views with more urgency?
So what I think modernisers want are two things. First, they want to make sure the Conservative Party is in touch with the modern world. It has answers to the issues that people care about. So things like public services, the environment, yes, gay rights. It's not abandoning our principles, is applying conservative principles to these modern issues that people care about. So that's the first thing. The second thing is really appealing to those on low incomes and really helping them with the cost of living and high quality public services. Because as Ashcroft polling shows, there is still a perception the Tory is the party, the Tory party is the party of the rich. We want to show actually it's the party for everybody. No matter what your identity or your background is, if you're united behind a belief in certain values, hard work, responsibility, then the Conservative Party's for you. Now, one thing about the modernisers is there's always a perception that it's just these so-called metropolitan issues, gay rights, green issues, for example, when actually modernisers in the early days were very concerned about addressing poverty and thinking about how you deal with that. And the critique went, actually, it's not just about cash transfers. And Labour, obviously, were very committed to that. So are there alternative ways, the big society, parenting, which might help lift people out of poverty?
Again, there will be people, you know, particularly obviously people on the left, but others as well, you know, and Lib Dems saying, come off it. Look at what the choices the Chancellor has actually made, the tax cut for millionaires, as they call it, but also, you know, just at the beginning of this week, saying, well, we've got to do more deficit reduction on the back of working age poor, and we're going to find another 12 billion, but we're not going to touch rich pensioner benefits. So, sorry, the likelihood is there's going to be people who depend on tax credits, young people who might want housing benefit, and disabled people are all now sort of in line for cuts, and you know, not being as sort of non-partisan as I can, you can see how, with well-meaning though a bright blue agenda might be, it doesn't seem to be really getting a serious look in between now and 2015.
Well, what my intervention in The Guardian over Christmas was that perhaps there is too much focus on trying to set the agenda based on clamping down on immigrants and clamping down on working age benefits. And we need a much more positive message on that. And indeed, I think there are people in government, in cabinet, and senior advisors as well, who want a more balanced human position. So, for example, this week, we know that people close to Ian Duncan Smith have said, we can't keep focusing on clamping down on working age benefits. It needs to be much broader than that. Well, that's for two reasons. First is, if you really want to reduce the deficit, you can't just look at working age benefits. It needs to be much wider. And indeed, majority of the welfare budget is spent on pensioners. But secondly, we can't be seen to be continuously clamping down on working age benefits. The universal credit, for example, is a positive narrative about helping people in poverty, making work pay, and the Conservatives need to be on the side of people who are trying their best to climb out of poverty. So we need a positive agenda. So I think there are a lot of voices who are starting to rear their head over Christmas and now, who want that more positive, humane message to come out.
Do you get a sense then that, I mean, I've spoken to other, you know, modernisers, advisors, people, you know, in Conservative MPs, who are saying actually there is a battle now on for the soul of this party. We cannot just carry on trying to be UKIP light, because even if that claws us towards the finish line in 2015, it massively sets us back for afterwards, you know, whether you win or not, for being a party that speaks for all people. And I wonder if, you know, sort of last question really, whether you get a sense that actually, you know, you suggest there's a sort of a silent, if not the majority, but there's a lot more people who are sympathetic to this agenda than express it in public and then express concern about the direction the Conservatives are taking. Do you think that's going to start coming out more over the next few months?
I think so. And I think it's important that people who are modernisers in the party, both MPs and campaign groups around, really promote that more human, progressive conservatism that we want to see. Because at the end of the day, people are attracted by an optimistic, original message. And at the moment, it seems that Downing Street is too transfixed in trying to respond to agendas set by Labour and UKIP. So Labour.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Talking very strongly about cost of living, UKIP obviously around immigration in Europe, and Downing Street shouldn't feel like they need to respond all the time to those agendas. Of course, have policies on them, but set a clear, positive, original narrative where people can be drawn to it. And indeed, the Big Society was all about that. It was distinct. It was something which was distinctly conservative and spoke to the modern times. So I think we need to get back to a sort
of positive
optimism.
Do you think the Big Society, they can't rehabilitate that now, can they? Or do you sense that moment has passed? You need something else, another story, whether it's the global race or something. It has to be something else that is the forward-looking, optimistic pitch.
Well, I think the thing about Big Society, it wasn't clearly defined, and as a result, it meant so many things to different people that it was just not a doorstep seller. But there needs to be a conservatism which is much more human and optimistic, which is optimistic about people's life chances and values ambition, but also nurtures the bonds that we have in communities, but also in families. And that's when Cameron's at his best, I think, as a family man who's positive about people, particularly people in poverty. And I think that's what we need to return to.
Great. Thank you, Ryan Shorthouse. Thank you very much.
Internet trolling or internet abuse has been in the news again this week with the conviction of two people for harassing feminist campaigner Caroline Criado Perez. I'm joined by our columnist Laurie Penny, who's been writing about misogyny on the internet for several years, and our tech reporter Ian Steadman to discuss where we might go next. So Laurie, first of all, I want to talk to you because you sort of sparked off my interest in this when I saw the kind of absurd levels of hatred that you got, particularly on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Has that got better or worse over the last 2 years?
I think there's certainly been a change, particularly among what I'd call the commentariat in the UK. I think there is still an astonishing level of viciousness that comes from the online community in terms of the 4chan end of it. But there is less, slightly less, casual misogyny amongst your pale, stale and male commentators from across the internet spectrum. Of course, we won't name names, particularly on this podcast. I think that there's been more of a understanding that maybe that's not all right. But the volume of trolling, and of course, you know, you can call it, some people don't like it when you call it trolling, the volume of attacks has not really let up. I think it has become slightly easier to manage in some ways because people are more aware of it. The big thing that's changed is the conversation around it. It doesn't feel anymore like it's something that I can't talk about, something that I just have to put up with. Nobody is saying to me anymore, well, fewer people are saying to me, oh, well, that's just what happens if you're a girl and you write online.
I think the big success that there's been in the last 2 years is that kind of consciousness raising point of saying, mm-hmm. like, people just, I don't think we're aware. I remember when I published that first article, people just had no idea. Even actually people like older female columnists who'd always been published and had always had, you know, very well-maintained comment sections. They hadn't had got any idea that this was what the kind of unmediated flow of stuff that came towards people was like. And now I just don't think you would hear you hear very few people make. I'm sure Brendan O'Neill somewhere in a bin is shouting into it about how women just need to toughen up. But, you know, generally the level of conversation has changed. Ian, what has changed in about the way that internet companies have regarded this issue?
Well, the big ones have been generally quite slow to respond to it. Facebook and Twitter in particular. Twitter very recently kind of rushed through this report abuse button where you can, similar to report spam, you can report someone for sending abusive tweets or messages. Facebook has kind of, over the years, very gradually sort of conceded ground to various governments around the world when it's come to this kind of issue. These companies, I guess, tend to be American and therefore have that attitude of sort of the First Amendment free speech. Mm-hmm. It's not really their job. They're the medium through which this is conducted. It's not their job to police speech. Probably a few of them probably think that it's not really the job of people to put to police speech in that way, which is obviously
one of the interesting things I think that's happened with Facebook. Is I was talking to Whitney Phillips, who's researched kind of subcultural trolling, i.e. not specifically abuse, more people just doing things to get a reaction, the kind of some of what 4chan does, you know, trying to create hoaxes, trying to create anger. And she says the one thing that's really changed about Facebook is that they begin to graph people's relationships so much better, and they want to insist on you putting as many personal details as you can about yourself. So they, because they want to sell your data to advertisers, they want to target you, they want to target your friends. So actually they've become much better at spotting accounts which have recently been created, don't have any friends, or are friends only with other people that are engaged with problematic behaviour, because they can see your where you are in a web of people. They've actually found it a lot easier to target people, for example, who've done things like created offensive sites or spammed memorial sites for dead teenagers. I think Twitter probably is a different case, because they are, because you can start a Twitter account and then you can instantly talk to whoever you want, whereas, you know, Facebook is now pretty locked down.
I
mean, I get several, it's a regular occurrence for me that I'll be trolled and sent horrific abusive messages by some random Twitter account, and I'll go to the page to block the account and I'll see that they've tweeted 7 times all at me and they've got no followers. It's just random stuff, accounts like that. But I think the interesting issue with Facebook and Twitter and calling on companies to regulate speech is, of course, there's a cultural difference there, particularly between the UK and the US, because the US has such a such a guarded position about speech and protected speech. But it's also the case that we seem to be talking about creating a technological fix for something that is not a technological problem. Most of the discussion around trolling has been around the idea that the problem is one of anonymity, the idea that that people do this stuff because they can get away with it, and the cases like Isabella Sawley.
I think there's an interesting kind of division between anonymity and lack of consequences, because if you talk to the researchers in this, they'll say, well, actually, you're anonymous in a lot of situations in your everyday life, effectively, but you have a face and a presence, and you feel that actually what you fear most of all, why people don't shout abuse at other people on the bus, generally, is fear of social disapproval and feeling the immediate effect of lots of people sitting around you looking at you disapprovingly, which is a very powerful patrolling thing. That's what you don't have on the internet.
And that's why the most important cultural change is not getting the people who control Twitter and Facebook to take a different stance on abuse. I don't think the change is going to be top-down. The change will come when people understand that there are consequences and social consequences to behaving in this way towards women, people of colour, transsexual people, that there are consequences for harassment, because at the moment, as in many situations in what we previously thought of as the real world, there are no consequences for people who harass. It's there was in a couple of TED Talks I've seen recently about masculinity and the behaviour and sexual harassment, physical sexual harassment. The discussion has been along the lines of, we must create consequences for men who do this stuff, because men perform this as a way of as a way of performing their masculinity, because there are no consequences. But obviously, it's not just men.
No, No, and actually researchers into things like gang rape will probably tell you the same, is that a lot of that is actually about the relationships between the men involved. They're performing masculinity in front of each other, essentially. But that's okay, so Ian, I'm going to invite you to wade into firestorm. How much is it men's problem?
How much is it? I'm being asked to speak for my entire
chat.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
I hope you had a chat with all men recently.
I think this is part of a... I totally agree. It's part of a larger thing. It ties into things like rape culture and the emphasis on condemning women for acting in ways that encourage rapists to rape them rather than condemning the rapist. You know, it's all part of these larger patriarchal problems.
Although one thing that is reassuring is I don't hear as much of what I used to hear 2 years ago, which was either... why don't women use gender-neutral names then?
Yeah.
Or why don't you get off Twitter? And like, why are you on Twitter anyway? And you, which was, again, is exactly that rape culture point of, why don't you change your behaviour so that your present, your exactly. mere existence is less offensive to other people? So maybe that is a sign that
the argument, of course, is the is about the policing of women in public space, and the internet functions as public space.
Mm.
The idea that you can just get off Twitter, I mean... I could get off Twitter, but Twitter is where I talk to my friends, it's where I promote my work, it's where I find out what's going on in the world, it's where I do a lot of my social interaction. And it's, to me, it's the same argument as telling a girl that if she doesn't want to get raped, she should just stay home. It's telling women to leave public space to protect themselves, and that's the discourse that needs to change here. It needs to be talking to abusers and to people who are participating in that culture and saying it is on you to change. And I think the consciousness raising has been really effective, not just in telling women that it's all right to take up space and it's all right to be in public and online as women, but in making it clear to other people that this is going on. I've seen some really, really heartening reactions from men, actually, particularly when... you know, I just hit retweet on a horrible tweet that's sent to me, which I know some people have criticised.
Well, that's interesting, because there's always the question about... So I find them really grappling hard, but because if you talk to trolling researchers, they will say what these people want is an emotional reaction. Often in a lot of cases, they just want to know that their words have had an effect. So in some ways, the worst thing you can do is show that you're hurt and upset. I think there's also another problem with... retweeting about the kind of, particularly if you've got a lot of followers, are you sort of throwing people to the wolves, as it were? Sometimes it works. The guy who abused Mary Beard, who was a young student,
yes.
who'd won and won, not the abuse of Mary Beard, but another one, he sent something about how she looked really ugly on TV. She retweeted him. He was so apologetic and shamed, and like someone got in touch with his mum, and it just seemed like that was a really positive experience. But generally, what do you do when you get abuse now?
There are several things. Often I just block, and some of it's got better just because I'm like the fastest draw on the block button. But I also retweet stuff. I talk to people about it, and that kind of daily activism is something I feel that without quite meaning to become involved in. I mean, I wish that over the past few years, this hadn't had to be part of the feminist work I do. Really, I didn't... when I started writing online and doing feminist work, I didn't intend to be talking about online abuse. And I wrote a book, Cyber Sexism, which has came out last summer.
It's available at all good ebook shops.
Actually, not all good ones, just Amazon. Right. But...
But that's an interesting point, because there's been a lot of disquiet about the fact, has this dominated the conversation too much,
yeah.
and has this crowded out other issues from feminism, and to which my position has always been, you have to first argue for the right for women to speak at all.
Yeah.
And you know, people like us, we put ourselves out there, and we should expect a level of criticism, certainly, maybe even a level of people just want to think you're ugly. Well, that's fine. But I do think that there is a big issue generally about, you know, you hear people who run a blog for like their 10 friends that's about cakes,
yes.
and suddenly they're flooded with, like, their comment inbox is flooded with rape threats. That's the bit that probably doesn't get, and I do worry that it looks like high profile women complaining.
Are the only person who get abused.
Yeah. And that's definitely not true. And I'm sure that there are, like you say, there's plenty of transgender people of colour. The Guardian did a series where they asked Mehdi Hassan, our columnist, and several other writers to write about the abuse they got because they're Muslim online and the forms that takes. And I think that this is a big social problem. So, Ian, how do we fix it?
Oh god!
Just quickly to finish.
Have all the practical
steps that have been. Do you think realistically there is anything Twitter can do at this point? Have they done all the things
beyond crippling their own service and thus the way they're going to make money? No. So I mean, the only way you can fix it. I mean, I'm not going to suggest a solution because I honestly am not the person to ask here. But anything further that they're going to do, you're going to have to force them to do because you're going to force them to cripple their own business model.
But I get current. What gives me a slight amount of hope is actually weirdly advertising and the advertising mm-hmm. revenue of the internet mm. is that it is in, for example, Google's interest that you are signed in constantly so they can build up a really accurate profile of you. It is in everyone whose business on the internet depends on advertising wants to know more about you. People are encouraged to give more information. That, I hope, increases people's investment in their online identity as something mm-hmm. that they feel is coexistent with their offline identity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I wish this wasn't ending just now because there's so much I want to say about privacy and anonymity now, but we have to people's access to the digital
in which
commons.
Case you will be given a rare invitation back to the New Statesman podcast right. to talk about this, but for now, Laurie and Ian, thank you very much. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, which you can find every week on iTunes and at newstatesman.com/podcast. It's produced by Philip Morn and Caroline Crampton, and our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.